Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Indian Tribal Court Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 7, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Dollar General Corporation v. Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. This case concerns a dispute over tribal court jurisdiction relating to allegations that the non-Indian manager of a Dollar General store on Choctaw tribal land sexually molested an Indian minor who interned at the store. When the minor's parents sought to hold Dolgan Corp, the subsidiary that operated the store, vicariously liable for the manager's conduct, Dolgan Corp petitioned in federal district court for an injunction barring tribal court proceedings on the grounds that the tribal court lacked jurisdiction. The district court denied relief, concluding that while tribal courts typically lack civil authority over the conduct of non-members on non-Indian land within a reservation, Dolgan Corp's situation fell within a consensual relationship exception to the rule. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit affirmed and denied rehearing en banc over the dissent of five judges. The question before the Supreme Court is whether Indian tribal courts have jurisdiction to adjudicate civil tort claims against non-members, including as a means of regulating the conduct of non-members who enter into consensual relationships with the tribe or its members. To discuss the case, we have Zachary Price, who is Associate Professor of Law at University of California Hastings College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Price.
This case is potentially a very big deal for federal Indian law, and since I know many listeners may not know much about this particular area of law, I want to focus in this brief podcast on trying to explain why the case is important and also why it's likely to be controversial and may well sharply divide the justices. Federal Indian law in general, I think, is an exceptionally difficult area of law because it relates to our country's troubling history with its native peoples and the appalling abuse that those peoples have suffered throughout much of our country's history. And this case is difficult in many ways, partly because it implicates some really fundamental questions about how our legal system should respond to that troubling history today. Let me get into the case by first of all describing the basic facts and procedural posture. So the specific question presented in Dollar General is jurisdictional. It's whether tribal courts, meaning courts of a federally recognized Indian tribe, can exercise tort jurisdiction over someone who is not a member of the tribe. The specific tort alleged in this case is the sexual abuse of a minor, and this happened on a store operated by the defendant in the tribal court proceedings, the Dollar General Corporation. So Dollar General, as you may know, operates a nationwide chain of retail stores, and it opened a store on lands controlled by the Mississippi Choctaw Indian tribe. The manager at the store agreed on the company's behalf to participate in a tribal youth opportunity program, a program that placed young tribal members in internships basically at local businesses. This manager then allegedly molested a 13-year-old participant in the youth program at the store, and this victim is now suing the store for tort damages. It originally sued both the manager and the store, and its theory against the store was both one of vicarious liability for the manager's torts, as well as negligent failure to train and supervise. Now, the issue in the case before the Supreme Court arises because the victim brought this suit not in state or federal court, but in a tribal court of the Mississippi Choctaw. The defendants moved to dismiss the case for lack of jurisdiction, but tribal courts denied their motion. So the defendants then went instead to federal court seeking an anti-suit injunction based on the tribal court's alleged lack of jurisdiction. The district court actually held that the tribal court lacked jurisdiction over the individual manager, but upheld jurisdiction over Dollar General, and a divided panel of the Fifth Circuit affirmed. So now the issue before the Supreme Court is whether the Fifth Circuit was correct to hold that tribal court could adjudicate this type of dispute with respect to defendants who are not members of the tribe. Here the defendant is a corporation, but it's not owned or controlled by tribal members, so it's not a member of the tribe in that sense. So that's the basic question. Now, what's the governing law? How does the court go about deciding it? So to explain the issues, I need to provide a bit of background about the overall doctrinal structure of federal Indian law. This can get very complicated, but I'm going to try and keep things relatively simple. the basic foundational premise of modern federal Indian law sort of twofold. On the one hand, Native American tribes are thought to have an inherent sovereignty that precedes the U.S. Constitution, basically exists outside of it. That's because Native Americans, of course, were here first. Tribes existed as self-governing communities before the United States, and under the theory of modern federal Indian law, they preserve aspects of that inherent pre-constitutional sovereignty. But on the other hand, Congress has so-called plenary authority over Native American tribes, plenary authority to regulate the extent of their sovereignty and how they exercise it. Where this comes from is not entirely clear. The Constitution actually says surprisingly little about how Native Americans fit into the constitutional architecture. But since the late 19th century, based on the so-called Indian Commerce Clause, which says Congress can regulate commerce with the Indian tribes, and also based on some sort of structural inferences, the Supreme Court has held that Congress has this sort of plenary authority over Native American tribes. So this plenary authority means that Congress can divest tribes of sovereignty, but it can also preserve that sovereignty or even restore it after it's been taken away. And importantly, because tribal sovereignty precedes the Constitution and under the theory exists outside of it, tribal exercises of governmental power are actually not directly constrained by the Constitution, including, importantly, the Bill of Rights. There's now a statute called the Indian Civil Rights Act that requires them to follow many provisions of the Bill of Rights, including basic due process protections, but it doesn't apply the entire Bill of Rights, at least not as judicially interpreted, directly to tribes and their court systems. So that's an important basic sort of background structure that's important to understand in terms of the debates in this case. Congress has plenary power over Native American tribes. They can exercise that authority to preserve their sovereignty or to take it away or to regulate the way in which they exercise it. Now, in recent decades, Congress and the executive branch, the political branches, have generally supported tribal self-determination and tribal sovereignty. And tribal courts, like the ones asserting jurisdiction in this case, reflect an effort by tribes to function as more complete sovereigns and perform basic governmental functions for themselves. But the issues in this case come up because while the political branches have generally supported tribal authority, the Supreme Court has pushed back in a series of controversial federal common law cases. In these decisions, the court has held that even without any particular statute divesting tribes of jurisdiction, the tribes' very incorporation into the United States has, quote, implicitly divested them of certain aspects of sovereignty with respect to people who are not members of the tribe. The first case in this line dealt with tribal criminal jurisdiction. The Supreme Court held that tribes, without more specific authorization from Congress, at least could not criminally prosecute people who weren't members of the tribe. Congress has now partially restored that authority, but tribal criminal jurisdiction over non-members remains limited as a function of these implicit divestiture decisions. With respect to civil jurisdiction, the doctrine is more complicated. The court has held that tribes have also been implicitly divested of certain aspects of civil governmental authority over non-members, but at the same time, it has recognized that they can continue to exercise jurisdiction in certain types of cases. And one of those, the one that's mainly at issue here, is they've said that tribes can regulate, quote, activities of non-members who enter consensual relationships with the tribe or its members through commercial dealing, contracts, leases, or other arrangements. So in essence, under this principle, which is called one of the Montana exceptions after the case called Montana versus the United States that first addressed these principles for civil jurisdiction, the tribes retain sovereignty over non-members if there's a qualifying, quote, consensual relationship with the tribe. Now, I should say, I'm simplifying things quite a bit. There are a lot of other arguments in the case, including some suggesting that this isn't the right framework for analyzing the problem. But judging at least by the oral argument, it seems that the case is likely to turn on this question of consent and this particular Montana exception. So let me turn now to sort of what the arguments are on this point, and I'll first sort of describe the basic doctrinal arguments and then circle back to the big picture and sort of try and say something about why the case raises strong feelings on both sides. So on a basic doctrinal level, the tribe argues essentially that Dollar General's activities here are a very easy case for consent to tribal jurisdiction under that Montana exception. First of all, Dollar General, of course, opened a store on tribal lands. But beyond that, it also signed a lease with the tribe, and the lease included a specific forum selection clause that provided for tribal jurisdiction over lease-related disputes. It also obtained a tribal business license to operate the store, and ultimately it agreed to participate in this youth opportunity program that led to the alleged tort. So in the tribe's view, it is a pretty easy case for constructive consent. So if Montana's consensual relationship exception means anything beyond requiring very specific express consent, it should apply on these facts. Delaware General argues to the contrary, that it consented only to tribal jurisdiction over lease-related disputes, not this sort of general tort claim, which the plaintiffs could bring instead in state or possibly even federal court. And so they want the court to hold that the tribe should have to require much more explicit consent to tort jurisdiction if it wants Delaware General to be subject to it. So those are the sort of narrow doctrinal arguments in terms of that exception. But as I said, they intersect with some much larger debates that I think are likely to inform how the justices approach the case, and that indeed were very much front and center in the oral argument. So first of all, from the tribe's point of view, why is this case important? It's important because the sort of sovereignty that the Mississippi Choctaw are asserting in this case is very important to the tribe's self-government. And from that point of view, the whole line of implicit divestiture cases is sort of an affront to the sovereign dignity of tribes, to their existence as independent political entities. There are also very important practical implications of these limits on tribal authority. As I said, many tribes have been working to promote development, improve the lives of their members by exercising greater self-determination. And part of that effort has been, for many tribes, an effort to develop more modern court systems that take due process obligations seriously and enable the tribe to function as a more complete governmental authority. There's also the practical concern that many reservations confront very serious law and order problems that result at least in part from limitations on tribal authority. To the extent tribes lack sovereign authority themselves, their members and other people who live on the reservation are dependent on state or federal authorities to maintain law and order, and those authorities are often geographically remote and focused on other priorities. So that's the tribal perspective. Sovereignty is very important to them, and this type of regulatory authority over activities occurring on tribal lands is a basic expression of their sovereign dignity and as a practical matter, important to their ability to control what happens on tribal lands. The competing point of view, though, that seems to motivate some of the justices, particularly the, at least judging by the oral argument, the five more conservative members, is more focused on the individual defendant, a non-Indian defendant in tribal court, as opposed to that perspective of starting from the point of view of the tribe. So tribes are, of course, unique political entities within the American polity, partly because their membership is defined by blood. That means that non-Indians, including even those who live on reservations, possibly even on tribal lands, may never be able to participate equally in tribal government, or in some cases even serve on juries in tribal courts. The tribe, moreover, may have customs and traditions that are quite different from Anglo-American legal traditions, and some justices seem to worry that tribal authorities, or at least tribal juries, will be inclined to favor tribal members over non-members. At least this is a point that Chief Justice Roberts in particular harped on with respect to juries repeatedly during the oral argument. It's also important here that tribal court judgments are not subject to direct review in the U.S. Supreme Court, at least under current statutory arrangements, and there's also no removal statute. So an out-of-state defendant sued in state court could generally remove the case to federal court, but a non-member defendant in a tribal court can't do that. They can go to federal court, as the defendants did here, and seek to enjoin the litigation on the theory that the tribal court lacks jurisdiction. Also, if the plaintiff wins a civil suit and then seeks enforcement of the tribal court judgment against off-reservation assets, the defendant might be able to argue that the judgment doesn't deserve recognition by a federal or state court because it was fundamentally unfair. But otherwise, if the tribal court has jurisdiction and it's a civil case, defendant doesn't have a vehicle for directly attacking the judgment in some other forum. So, as I said, some justices seem troubled by this arrangement, and indeed some of them in the sort of strongest form of this concern, and Justice Kennedy has been particularly vocal in expressing this view, both in oral argument and in some prior opinions, some of them have suggested that it could actually be unconstitutional for tribes to exercise this sort of authority over a defendant, at least without very specific consent, even if Congress specifically provides for it. The basic idea there is that the Constitution doesn't allow Congress to expose U.S. citizens to the authority of an entity that exists entirely outside the constitutional structure, isn't regulated by the Constitution, at least without very specific consent from that particular defendant. So Delaware General has actually pushed quite hard on these themes in its argument in the case, and for better or worse, it certainly seemed from the oral argument like they were having some resonance with the justices. And it's always hard to predict, but judging by the oral argument, it seemed like we might be headed towards a 5-4 decision in Delaware General's favor. But it could nonetheless be very important how narrowly or broadly the court rules. The court might narrowly hold that tribes can't impose punitive damages, or perhaps somewhat more broadly, that they can't adjudicate tort disputes based on unwritten common law without express consent from the defendant or clear authorization from Congress. It's possible that the court would go even further and say that jurisdiction is unconstitutional, even if Congress specifically provides for it. A ruling of that sort would have very profound implications for a much broader area of federal Indian law questions. But for that reason, I think it's unlikely the court will go that far, though we could see some concurring opinions of that sort. For what it's worth, my own point of view is that I think if that is the likely outcome, and of course this prediction could be wrong, I tend to think it would be unfortunate. I think the tribe should probably win this case, and in any event, the court should decide the case narrowly. The sort of concerns about structural bias, procedural unfairness, and unchecked tribal authority that some of the justices expressed at oral argument, those might well be well founded in some cases, but they actually don't seem particularly compelling in this particular case. By all accounts, the Mississippi Band of Choctaw have a model tribal court system, and what's more, the case for constructive consent here is very strong. And beyond that, the tribe has an interest in adjudicating the case in a responsible fashion. If its courts are perceived to have treated Delaware General unfairly, other businesses will presumably be much less inclined to make investments on tribal lands in the future. And in any event, if the tribal court does enter a large judgment in the plaintiff's favor, the plaintiffs would probably need to enforce that judgment in federal or state courts, which could then assess the fairness of what the tribe did in deciding whether to afford comity to the tribal court's judgment, just as they would do with a judgment from a foreign sovereign overseas. So I think the court should find a way to enable tribes to exercise the sort of tort jurisdiction based on constructive consent on facts like these, while perhaps reserving the question whether the same rule would apply if there are more specific reasons to worry about unfair treatment of defendants in the particular case. But as I said, it did seem from your argument like the Delaware General is likely to win, and so the question will then become what happens if that's the case. Assuming the court at least preserves the possibility as a constitutional matter of restoring tribal sovereignty, then the action will move to Congress. The tribes actually recently succeeded in persuading Congress to restore certain aspects of criminal jurisdiction, in particular jurisdiction over certain domestic violence offenses against tribal members. That victory suggests they might succeed here as well in restoring tribal tort jurisdiction. And indeed, Mississippi and a number of other states are supporting the tribe here as amici and might be politically supportive of that effort. But the ultimate outcome of any such political process, of course, would be quite uncertain. So in any event, the court's decision is bound to be an important new precedent in the doctrinal evolution of federal Indian law and likely will be controversial one way or another, no matter what the tribe does. But it'll be interesting to see what the court decides when it releases its opinions later this term.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.